evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of Warrior Connection. We're running down on 2012 rapidly. It's the end of December, and we got some cold weather here in Illinois. Denise, are you with us?
Yes, I am, Doug.
What's the weather out in Denver?
Oh, it's been running around 20 to 30 degrees, and we had snow, a light coating of snow, about three, four inches, I guess, right before Christmas. Been bitter cold.
Yeah, just what we expect for winter. Well, you know, some 20-odd years ago, both you and I were in the desert, on the way to the desert, in Operation Desert Storm, and I think most everybody is aware, and I know it was a major event for our lives now and also a major event before. General Norman Schwarzkopf has died this last week.
Yes, very sad. I think everybody has mixed feelings. I think we're all proud of him, of his history, and we were proud of the service he performed. But, you know, there's another side. There's another side of this, Doug, that we had chemical exposures, we had PV, we had depleted uranium, we had vaccines, the sand. We've talked about this on other programs. But, you know, I still feel there's a mixed exposure and everything kind of combines and has an additive effect, synergistic. But, you know, the general testified, and I was just uploading to Facebook a whole series of links for people to review for history basis. And there was a lot of us trying to get the general to stand up strong for Gulf War vets. To stand up strong, if he truly believed in what he said, that he cared for his troops, you know, why wasn't he leading the charge up on the Hill? He testified one time to the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee. Why wasn't he the leader to say, you're going to take care of them? We don't care what the exposures are, or tell what you know because or don't know. Where there was ambiguities, you know, put it on record of, yes, we need to research that to see if there's medical treatments for them, which is the game plan here. We got to get to some treatments for 22 years now. And what we've all wanted from the very beginning was tell us what happened truthfully, completely, do not hide anything. Because without that, the researchers, you know, kind of have to shoot in the dark and shoot a shotgun blast.
You'd been in, I mean, we'd worked together. I mean, as you know, and you've seen the documents, Bowers Raiders and our team.
I just wanted to finish my thought.
Sure.
The first thing that needed to be done was to get everything out on the table that was known, that was questionable, debate it honestly and completely. And I think Senator Riegel did that. I think Congressman Shays has done that. Bernie Sanders, Kaczynski, there's been a handful up on the Hill, and we're losing people left and right from having districts combined, and we've lost Kaczynski up there, which is a shame. But, you know, we needed everything on the table as soon as possible. And, you know, it went from the first hearings were 93, I think it was 93, and then 94. And then we took off on hearings through the 90s. We had the PAC, Foreign Presidential Advisory Committee. We had the extension of that. Then we had a Presidential Oversight Board. Then we had all these different things. Now, if everything had been laid at the table early in full discussions back in the 90s, we would be further along in taking care of our Gulf War vets. And that's what I'm upset about, is that we were all over the place in the 90s. I mean, we had the Office of Special Investigation and going around in town hall meetings. And what was lacking here was a complete open the books, let's find out what's wrong now, let's learn the lessons from Agent Orange, let's set this record straight. And never again are we going to have vets wage a war after they come home from a war. and we get them, you know, get them compensated while we try to find the right diagnostic test for them, the right treatment. You give them the benefit of the doubt. You take care of your troops. And this is why, you know, when the general died, and I liked him, I respected him, I was let down that he didn't lead the charge to say, hey, it doesn't matter. We've got to take care of them. And the compensation shouldn't be a battle for the troops to get help to when they're sick. And then you get the right stuff going of the diagnostic test and then, you know, treatment modalities. We're 22 years into this, and we just started getting good research, I guess, around 2005 when we fought for funding for a CDMRP, and we have to fight that every year. Right now, we're hung up. We don't know how much we will get, even though Kachinik went on the floor, got us $10 million, and the VA cut the funding for research. He went back, and supposedly total was $20 million. We don't know because the appropriations bill is still waiting in the wings. Yes, the authorization bill went through, but the appropriations is what you really need to know. So, you know, periodically before that, we had Dr. Haley working. We had different doctors and researchers. You know, the red flags were waving from that initial research that was, a lot of it was self-funded by Perot. You know, there was a lot of good research. Duke University did some. Abadani there, not the Abadani that we had on the show, but another scientist. And, you know, we have been fouled up for 22 years because all the cards weren't on the table so that we could do it legitimately. There was a lot of time wasted fighting about the Kamacia bunkers, the air bombing. You know, it's a repeat of what we saw with the atomic vets and with the Agent Orange vets. And the sad thing is they never learned the lesson, the burn pit vets from OIF are having the fight. We have the situation with the lawsuit for the Navy vets that were over in Japan providing humanitarian response and getting radiation exposures. That is the thing. We've wasted time providing the care by denial, delay, obscuring. You know, I don't want to call it lying, but somehow agencies in the government didn't talk to each other. CIA finally came out and said, yeah, didn't y'all get the message on Kamacia? You know, whatever it was, all that could have been laid out in the early years, and we would be taking care of our vets better now. So there is a mixed feeling out in the veterans community. People loved Storm and Norman. They loved him. The Senate called him a hero. We were dashing the myths of the Vietnam War away, and we had to protect reputations, and there was going to be a cost factor. That's what it gets down to. Reputations, a cost factor, damages to the indigenous population, just like we have in Vietnam. And what really makes me sad is all the time and effort from you, from Paul Sullivan, from Anthony Hardy, myself, that we've gone up and had to do battle. A small group of rebel forces, I guess you would say, trying to get the truth out so we could get help to our troops. Not so much for ourselves, but for all that served with us. And so we're looking at history now, and January was the start of the air war. Jim Tuitt, who was involved with the Regal Report, he had worked on this for years, you know, not only the bunkers, but in the Regal Report, we talked about the air war bombing. Well, the IOM, National Academy of Science, when they're contracted by the VA, are limited to whatever the contract reads from the VA. And peer-reviewed research in medical journals are needed. Well, Doug, you and I know that there's a lot of research done in the Army medical field that is not published in a peer review. and all research should be published. The taxpayers are paying for that, okay? Whether it's true, whether you found something that's not true, or it's wrong, or it's right on, it needs to be published. Well, the congressional hearings and the investigations and all those reports are not published in a peer-reviewed journal. Just before Christmas, what happened was we got two peer-reviewed journal articles. And people are going, it's old news, how's that going to be different? Well, first of all, the air war campaign and the chemical alarms going off that Jim Tewitt had worked on since 93 or 92 had never been put into a peer-reviewed medical journal. So that could never be looked at by the IOM or National Academy of Science by the rules they had set on them. And then, so that was one article. The other article was Haley putting together the neurological damage, the things he's done, with, you know, the epidemiology, with the, you know, actual findings from hearings, reports, work done to show the meteorological, the winds, the pattern of fallout, downwind hazard type thing. So it is a first. It is something different to get it into a peer-reviewed journal that the National Academy of Science Institute of Medicine now has to look at. Are we any closer? Heaven help us, I hope we are. 22 years, we've lost a lot of vets. I remember sitting at a VA Research Advisory Committee on Gulf War Illness Research, which, by the way, was by act of law that was pushed through from our supporters on the Hill and veterans. It was not a voluntarily done by the VA. But they are having a meeting coming up in February, I think 3rd and 4th or 4th and 5th of February. But will this break the doors down? Gets us a little closer in the door? The vets are still having to fight their claims, prove that they were there. Raiders not considering the DD-214 and asking for your travel vouchers or, you know, whatever. I mean, that's not appropriate with presumptions in there. They shouldn't have to do that. We've got good researchers involved now. We've had to turn away from the VA and DOD and go to the CDMRP, which is a little different. It is a Department of Defense, but we don't have an independent funding site like the American Heart Association or any of those associations, and maybe that's what we need to set up and raise funds and be able to have our own board and have researchers funded. It's going to be hard, you know, with all the fiscal cuts coming down the road, but and that's going to hit veterans too. So do we hope it's going to get any better for Gulf War veterans? It's going to take all of us rising up and being tired as we are after 20-something years, activating the other vets that have not traveled, may not have read as we went along of everything that was happening, and knowing that there was a small band leading this fight. And it's going to take a large crowd. A large crowd, more than an army of one, to have this finally get out and dealt with.
I think when I think about this and everything that's happened over the years, and I mean, General Schwarzkopf, you know, became commander of CENTCOM before Desert Storm, so he was in that position when everything was being ramped up. And one thing he was totally aware of, and again, the RICO Commission report that Jim Tewitt worked on so well, and we have sat and discussed this with Jimmy many, many times, and he's put it out there trying to get help for everybody, verified that the U.S. had sent, not only sent, gave Iraq the chemical and biological warfare munitions that Iraq used on Iran during, after, you know, the 79 debacle and everything else that happened there when Iraq went to war with Iran. So the chemical and biological weapons, all the precursors, everything that was provided by the United States, England, Germany and the other countries. So that's, you know, totally there. The thing that bothers me the most of all of this is because, you know, when we were sent over very specifically to Desert Storm, our team was, Bowers Raiders, we knew that stuff was there. We had started preparing all of the training in the medical command before the invasion, or before Iraq actually invaded Kuwait. And we were all here to put that training in place and putting everything together. We formed the command assistance teams, CAT teams, where we went around and did all the teaching and training because we knew, as now is totally evidence, that Iraq absolutely had the chemical and biological weapons to include weaponized anthrax and also West Nile virus that was provided to them by the U.S. military and the U.S. Army. So when we got over there, and we finally got over there in the beginning of December of 1990, and we're putting all the warnings out, and General Schwarzkopf himself was totally involved in all of this, totally knew it. For example, and again, this again, we're looking at the anniversaries of it. When we look at his autobiography, It Doesn't Take a Hero, we'll go to page 390. And in here, he talks about the decision, and I'm just going to read this verbatim so everybody understands exactly what it happens. The date on this is 10 December 1990, C plus 125, 1533 hours. Phone con with the chairman. The leaders entered into a conversation regarding attacking biological warfare storage plants with the sink, pointing out that General Horner assured him that when we attack the plants, we have selective munitions that will kill the bugs. The SYNC followed this up by reminding the chairman that if we do not attack these plants, we cannot guarantee these agents won't be used on U.S. troops. This would be unforgivable sin. End quote. So General Schwarzkopf knew, and we've discussed this before on the show, we've discussed this at hearings, we've all over the place tried to get the information out to the troops. Jimmy Toot was instrumental with the Regal Commission report in getting a list of all these, only a partial list, but not totally, where we made the decision to blow up all of Iraq's chemical and biological stockpiles in place. Now, I mean, Denise, you were there report. With me when we talked with General Horner, what was that, March of 2001?
Yeah.
Specifically about this, and that was 10 years after the fact. And he was sick, we were all sick. It had become totally obvious that once we made the decision, and it was well over 100 sites that we bombed and blew up, and artillery strikes, and you know, special ground forces, you know, special forces, Green Berets, and SEALs going in and blowing stuff up, that we just spread this stuff all over. So here, the U.S. has provided Iraq with the chemical and biological stockpiles to use on Iran, that they also used on the Iraqi Kurds, that they absolutely did use on us through munitions of all different types, up and down all over into Kuwait, into Saudi Arabia, into Iraq, just you name it, it was all over the place. And so we had all this stuff happening. And so the decision was made. And for General Schwarzkopf, and again, this is the rub that I have, obviously, you know, he assigned me to do specific work for him by name, and our team was assigned to do work for him by name. And you've heard the story. I mean, you know, when he went up to Sapwan, he'd asked our team to fly up with him, and Ronald and I just sat down in the desert and waved him as he went away because we weren't going to go up there. We still get the pictures from that day. But for the man, over all the years, as our boss, knowing the truth, not to stand up and say, wait a minute, we knew the stuff was there, we knew what the health effects was, because we were teaching, and he knew perfectly well, all staff knew completely by this time, because they'd been, not only did they know before, but we had the refresher training that we did for them, and not to step forward to say, okay, we need to help you. I mean, he himself, and I mean, if I remember correctly, you'd been in contact with him and his staff over the years, and he himself was sick, and I guess he finally, you know, what he died from, they're saying pneumonia or respiratory complications, but he also did have cancer. I remember that, too. I think back, and I'm saying, this is what happened. This is the consequences thereof. These were decisions that were made by the generals, and yet they didn't stand up, come forward to help us get medical care. And it's not just the U.S. military, because we've got all the coalition military that are horribly affected.
Right.
We've got all of the Iraqis and the Kuwaitis and the Saudi military that are affected. And you've been to the conferences, and we've had a horrific health effects on the civilian populations in those regions, too. So, I mean, it's just been one thing after another.
Well, I want to pause here. There's two things I want to say. General Yoshoff is dead. General Stormin is dead. Our Special Forces General, dead. We're coming down to General Horner, General Luck, General Franks, Waller. These people need to step forward now. It's 22 years. They need to step forward as generals and stand up for their troops. We're going to have a battle that we need them in, because our Veterans Affairs budget, although it's supposed to be, you know, safe, I don't believe it will be in the end. But we need them now because of the financial situation of the government. And we have been ignored, delayed, denied long enough that before these generals die, they need to be called forward, lay everything on the table finally, so that we can move forward with all the information available and make a difference for those that are still living and putting up with the effects of exposures from the Gulf War. If we don't do that, and I know 96 time period, the recruiting command knew we were having an effect on recruiting in 96, 97. With 9/11, everybody got quiet. We're patriotic individuals. We stood up for the ones going, demanding that they have medical evaluations done with blood and urine, the whole bit, before and after coming home immediately, so that the errors wouldn't be repeated again. But as far as pushing our issue, we have kind of focused on getting the research funds and, you know, Haley's research, Dr. Kalimus's research, Dr. Galam's research, Dr. Leah Steele, and other researchers, to press ahead with research funds to try to find us some, you know, diagnostic tests that prove the point in our body. As I said at the first meeting I went to in D.C., is the proof in our body. You just got to see it, you know. You've got to have the right testing, or you have to look at what we were like before. And one of the things that we noticed and talked about then was our red blood cell counts were very definitely normal before we went, and then they went to borderline low. Those were hints and clues that were in our body. And Dr. Haley has stayed on point on neurological testing, you know, not a whole lot on other blood testing or even the chromosome damage, DNA damage, although there's one researcher working on it right now. There was one supposed to be funded, but never saw it coming up for vets to go donate blood and what have you. So, you know, we kind of shifted gears around 05 to trying to find treatments for this. And we've had to fight for funds every year. Well, if the whole truth was out there, I think our fight for funds every year would not be such a huge mammoth production that we have to go through. So that has been the battle on the research proven in our bodies that the damage was done. I think it's now time for any generals, any of the senior officers, you know, come forward, please. I know some of them are sick. We saw Horner. He was not healthy at the time we saw him 10 years after the war. It looked like maybe he was having some mini stroke type stuff going on just from watching him as a nurse. That, you know, we saw the things with his hands like you've experienced also. But please, officers, we respected you. It is time now to come out and support your troops that are sick, that are struggling with VA claims. It is your time to help lead us through this mess that's been created over 22 years. And so I put a call out to them to do that. I want to compliment you, Doug. You've been one of the troopers out there, along with Paul Lyons, Jim Brown, Paul Sullivan, that, you know, have not given up, despite all the controversies and interpersonal type things happening. We've all stuck to the premise that we're there for the other troops, and we believe in that. And I kind of want you to say what happened in theater, to go on record today of what occurred in theater. I know you've told me that somebody was tossed out of theater. I think it's time for you to go on record of what was really happening that you knew of there in the desert, and that it started kind of right then and there during the war.
There were a tremendous lot of problems. I mean, what I've already stated before, and we stated a few minutes ago, we knew that Iraq had the chemical and biological capability and the radiological capability that was provided to him by the U.S. Army. Again, the Regal Commission report verified what we had always known from day one. At MEDCOM, very specifically, and we've written this up, as you know, Bowers Raiders was formed very specifically and sent to theater for the chemical and biological and radiological threat, the hazardous materials threat, the preventive medicine threat. And probably the most senior officers that have attempted to do anything with that were members of Bowers Raiders.
Yeah, Corini Boff.
You know, Dr. Andres Corini Boff. I mean, he is now deceased. You know, he died.
What happened with him? Let's talk about the retaliation that occurred with him.
Well, you had both. I mean, Colonel Andres Corini Boff was actually in-laws with the certain general at that time, unfortunately. And he went over there originally as commander of one of the hospitals, on the frontline hospital. And because he knew the chemical and biological threat, tried to get everything all done, there was a direct conflict between him and the boss. I mean, we're talking about in-family and military conflict. And so as a consequence, he came on back to MEDCOM headquarters, and he got reassigned again to Bowers Raiders, which was probably the best thing could happen for the troops in the theater and everybody. Yeah, he had, you know, had stepped down from the commander of a major hospital on the front lines, but he actually went back where we started to teach and putting everything together. And so he raised up all these questions right away. I mean, immediately. When we started having the issues originally with the chemical and biological warfare munitions and the decision to destroy them, Andres Corini Boff, Colonel Tom Little, Colonel, it just becomes more, Command Sergeant Major Jim Runge, myself, Rollo Doff, all of us put the warnings out. We were working directly for DG Zulus, who was a medical commander at all that time, for the entire theater. We were coordinating everything again with the 3rd Army Chemo, Vicki Merriman, and everything else. We were basically the NBC cell at MEDCOM because we had all the expertise, and our team had been together for so many years. All of us had gone all the way back to Vietnam, and everything was put there. So all the warnings were put out. What had happened is the decision was made to limit the information that was going out to the commands. And so anyhow, two officers came over from the Office of the Surgeon General again, and they showed up. And their intent was to prevent the information and the training to getting out to the troops. Very specifically, they did not want everybody to know of Iraq's actual chemical and biological capabilities, where they were, and the fact that we had made the decision to blow everything up in place, knowing perfectly well all it was hitting an ice cube with a hammer, spreading it all over, never destroying everything.
Yeah, one of the things that the Regal report pointed out was the characteristics of sarin, and I think they thought wrongly that it would burn up. It does not burn up, and that was in the appendices. The Regal report.
We'd known all of this stuff because, again, what had happened is the chemical and biological weapons were given to Iraq, and that allowed us to write the Army medical Field Manual FM8-285, which is Medical Management, Chemical, Biological Casualties. That's the actual field manual, the medical manual dealing with this. And we use that to teach our course that we taught over there in theater immediately. It was sort of like when we got over to the theater right after the first week of December of 1990, and Rollo and I came walking over the hill, they go, here they come. You know, thank God they're here to start teaching us. And I think it was probably early December when we had the first major medical conference on the health and environment, medical management, hazardous materials, all of this stuff. And this was right there in Riyadh, at their equivalent of their, I guess Walter Reed would be the only way to describe it, and all the command staff was there. And obviously, as we started to do it, Colonel Bauer opened up the thing, and we were all sitting there starting to teach, and Andres was starting to teach, and all of us were starting to do everything. And Rollo and I had been, by this time, we'd started teaching chemical and biological warfare and combat medicine for the Army, I think back about 1982, something like that. 83 is when we totally got involved, and the team was actually formed formally under another colonel. But we now started teaching.
Two colonels, were they, that came in theater?
Yeah, there were two colonels, Dunn and Wade, that showed up in theater. Blanc and Ron Blanc had sent them over there specifically to put the kibosh on all the stuff that was going on to prevent the information from getting out. All the intelligence reports were out by this time. They had been hand-delivered to all the major commands in the Army, the Air Force, and the Marines and the Navy. All of them had those. They had all the intelligence reports by this time, full knowledge of where it was, what they had, what they could use, how it was being used, what to anticipate. We had all the medical management put in place. We had all the decon stations put together, the plans for that written up, how we're going to do the decon, what medical care and treatment would be provided. The big problem we ran into is we did not have enough supplies.
Right.
Because what it
happened... Now, did Dunn and Wade stay in theater?
Pardon me?
Did Dunn and Wade end up staying in theater?
No, they left.
Were they voluntarily left, or...?
There was a big argument between Dunn and Wade, General Zulus, Sergeant Major Fales, and Colonel Holland, and Colonel Little, and Colonel Andres Carnegie Bath, and they wanted us to stop teaching and everything, and Colonel Little told them to take a flying leap, and they went over to try to get General Zulus to stop us teaching, and they told him to take a flying leap, and they threw him out, and they left. But by this time, the damage had been put in place. So we had Humma Humma Perlman and all this stuff, Colonel Kennison, again, preventing the information from getting out, even though all the directives had gone out for the oil well fire.
Now, you said a name a while back that surfaced around 94 in the Regal Report, Merriman.
Vicki Merriman was the third Army or RSNT chemo. And she was down at Escan Village, where her headquarters was, where RSNT was. And so we were basically in adjoining buildings.
Because I remember her at the hearing, and even before the hearing, she was calling the vets and going, this hearing's not going to happen, trying to decrease our ability to get people there.
Well, she put a direct attempt to prevent Jimmy Toot from putting out the Regal Commission report also. You know, again, that's been documented. You know, so all this stuff was happening, and...
And you also had Colonel Durakovich over there in theater.
Well, yeah, U.S. Army Colonel Asa Durakovich, who has been Uranium Medical Research Center. He probably was a U.S. Army's expert on radiological and all this stuff, not only for the Army and for the VA. He was at the, I think, Wilmington, Delaware VA. He was Army Reserve. And, again, so we're looking at all the major players. Those senior colonels are the only ones that have continuously fought for help and trying to get help for us. Unfortunately, they're gone.
And Kilpatrick was over in Egypt with a biological lab or something,
correct,
right?
Michael Kilpatrick is actually a Navy captain, Michael Kilpatrick, and so he was over in Egypt basically around in around Cairo, and as the biological samples were collected, they were shipped over to him for the analysis and everything else. So Mike was totally aware of the biological problems.
And those analyses have never been made public, have they?
Pardon me?
And those analyses of all the samples he had have never been declassified and made public, right?
Not that I know of. I mean, you know,
I've never seen them. I know I used to jerk his chain, per se, and ask him where is the results of the, you know.
I think one of the most interesting, you know, Mike knew we were over there putting all the stuff together, putting all the training together, getting all the response. Jim Runge, Rollo Doff, all these stuff. Colonel Carmen, they were, you know, out there trying to get the information out, doing the on-site assessments, and everybody was getting sick right away. I mean, when we started finding out all of the foodborne illness medical problems, we found that out on almost immediately. We were having those reports before our team got to theater.
So this could track to Giardia and all the foodborne type stuff.
Correct. And one of the things that we
were never tested to see if they had Giardia, which can be treated. You know, when they came home, all those foodborne and the diarrhea and, you know, whether it was chemically induced or by the foodborne, you know, they weren't tested and treated. And some of this could have helped them maintain their health better.
One of the things that had happened is the U.S. Army, I'm not sure you're going to call it wisdom, had decided to get their foods provided through the local economy, local markets. And so you had the food preparers had not had any food handlers exams or anything for medical exams or anything else where the food was coming from. One thing that happened, and I mean, this happened to me personally, and you heard the story, you've talked to everybody, you've talked to the guys that saved my life that night, is I ended up being the guinea pig, because what we had found out is the fresh vegetables that we were getting had been grown in night soil, which is basically feces of all different types reused for fertilizer and put in to grow the crops. And what had happened is we had night soil contamination of the lettuce and the other vegetables. And so what had happened at the Riyadh, at the airfield right there, almost happened immediately when it went over, we had the stuff when we went down, and I went down sick. We were in a meeting discussing all of our battle plans and operation plans, what we need to do since we were the Theater Preventive Medicine Command, and all of a sudden I had to make a run. I mean, all I could do was get down to the, you know, the starlighters and then crawl back, and then they hand-carried me over to the ER and started all the IVs, and from there, you know, it was a whole bunch of us got hit at once, and all of a sudden, and Colonel Dave Trask and Colonel Thomas Little and Command Sergeant Jim Runge and Rollo Doff and all of us, they realized that what we had a serious problem with night soil, and so as a consequence, they put into place that all this stuff and everything, trying to get the fresh fruit and vegetables that are needed for to maintain the troops from another source. But the other thing, too, that everything had to go through a hypochloride wash. In other words, everything had to be bleached clean.
Right.
And to get everything done. So that was the very first indication that we had a real serious problem. And we found that even before we got on down to Escan Village. We'd basically landed and we're starting to eat and we went down. And so we immediately found that problem. And so all that stuff went on out. So we had all those problems immediately. The other thing that we ran into with the whole thing, again, this is in the report that we did for the Academy of Science Institute of Medicine, the misuse of pesticides. We knew that we had to use pesticides prior to leaving the United States. So when we were at Fort McCoy, Wisconsin, we made the arrangement to get the pesticide shipped over, understanding what the pest threat was and what the pesticide would be needed, and trying to get some EPA-certified pesticides in the right amounts and everything else, and then get proper pesticide training for use on that. I mean, those of us in the 12th of the command were probably some of the very few that were actually trained in pesticide use and application. I know I had gone through mine over many years because what
we
had done.
I know that up in Boston that they have a study group that is the pesticide handlers that are sick. So they've had a study group with that group of people that they've been following, Roberta White and that group out of Boston.
Yeah, and what had happened is because we were shipping bullets, bombs, and blood, the pesticides we needed didn't get into theater. And so as a consequence of the two colonels that were, one major, a doctor, and both of them were doctors, in fact, one a major and one a colonel, tried to get what they did and everything, tried to get it done right, but what happened, the pesticides got purchased on the local market with no controls and everything, and then they were totally misused. We had pesticide spraying all over, totally misused. We had all of the problems with the permethrin and the saturated in the uniforms and the clothes that try and keep the bugs off, and again, that stuff gets directly absorbed. With an animal or something, you don't have pesticides absorbed. Now we got pesticides absorbed when they're sweating everything directly in, leaching out of the clothes from the permethrin. Again, permethrin is a very dangerous pesticide. So we had all of this stuff. So I know when we wrote the report, it was around 2000, you were involved in helping with this. When we wrote that report, and again, it wasn't just me, it was the whole team that wrote it, even though I'm the one that did the, when I did the final report to IOM.
We provided that to the IOM, but again, a report like that that we hand in, public testimony, what have you, if it's not in the peer-reviewed journals.
Well, yeah, but none of this was peer-reviewed because we're dealing with the actual events. We're dealing with the actual reports. I mean, it was
This is what I'm bringing out, is that, like Jim Tewitt's work with Regal, with the exposures from the air bombing, which is significant because we're not just talking about the bunkers after the war being exploded. We're talking about the air war. The first month.
Yeah, that, well, those things,
and
they were blowing everything
up.
To get
that into a journal, a peer-reviewed one, it forces the IOM to give it credit and give it weight. And so I guess we need to get the report out and see if we can get it published in a peer-reviewed format and follow Jim Tewitt's example for us. But any of the reports that were done, and there was a lot of them, I'm thinking what happened to the sand sample, you know, with Kilpatrick. I'm thinking about Zulus probably had a report that I have never seen online on Gus Langton, official military with all the declassified documents. I don't think it's out there on the declassified documents. But also, again, unless they're peer-reviewed and in a peer-reviewed published journal, the IOM cannot give any credit to it. As the contracts are written, it has to be in a peer-reviewed, published medical journal.
We had that conversation, I mean, at the IOM with Harold Sox and Kathy Liberman. You and I had that, as did some of the other people directly involved. And I remember bringing that up with them, and they said it has to be peer-reviewed. And we're saying these are the actual reports of the actual events with the actual on-site measurements and the medical problems that were directly observed as it all occurred. But as you said, they discounted the peer-reviewed discounted because it was not in a peer-reviewed publication.
Right, well, the dictates are set, as I understand it, are set up by the contract that's written by the VA to the IOM. Those are the criteria. Or else the IOM, National Academy of Science, may have their own criteria, and it has to be peer-reviewed published.
Well, that's part of the problems we ran into with the VA, because when they actually had the actual on-site reports from the actual events, they're discrediting it and discounting it because, again, it's not a peer-reviewed publication. And, again, that's a, how do we want to put it? That was a setup like this in order to, as a smoke and screen. Okay, here is the actual stuff. It's certainly the epidemiology. Once we started seeing the epidemiology showing up all over in theater from the medical problems that we had and the exposures we had during Desert Storm, it became readily obvious, and that was part of the medical management, chemical, and biological casualties course that we did teach. The funny part about this, and I mean, you've been there, Mikey Kilpatrick disavows it. Any of us were there, we actually did it, we were the experts. And yet at the same time, and this happened at the Center for Disease Control, and you were right there, Mikey wanted the whole team to come back home and work for him. Remember that?
Yeah. Well, yeah, CDC, he grabbed me in the elevator and said, convince Doug to come back.
Well, he was after Andres, too, because if you remember, Colonel Andres Corney-Bott, God bless him, he is an angel now. He stood up in the Center for Disease Control meeting, and he told the entire truth with him and Colonel Dr. Herb Smith and Command Sergeant Major Jim Runge and Colonel Thomas, Dr. Thomas Little, had found on the on-site investigations for the oil well fires. You know, Mikey Kilpatrick did publish that list of what the partial list of what the byproducts were, and when you look at the byproducts that they had confirmed and what we know was confirmed beforehand, no wonder everybody was sick just from the oil well fires. I mean,
right, and then you combine that with, I believe, is used in oil drilling equipment, and if you've got oil fill fires burning, you have a source of DU there.
Yeah, the whole depleted uranium thing, and this again, because you have a copy and you've seen it.
Yeah.
General Schwarzkopf got an order from the Pentagon where he assigned me by name to clean up the depleted uranium mess. To this day, I have no idea why that order came down from the Pentagon to General Schwarzkopf and why General Schwarzkopf called me and gave me the order to go clean it up, but I'm still trying to finish that job.
Now, one of the things that wasn't looked at that Karini Both and a few others were looking at is with the air bombing and with this, I call it a downwind hazard, the sarin
sand
didn't
problems.
Burn up. The sarin gets mixed with the sand.
Yeah, correct. And Colonel Both and Colonel Little and Colonel Bauer had all brought this up right away. And what Andres had come up with this is LS can disease. Okay, and
but effectively, it was like a dusty agent.
Yeah, it was correct. It's like a dusty agent. Now, with the particulates and everything else, and with the dusty agents, again, the dusty agents are so fine particulates that you had to go to MOP level 5 in order to do anything. Okay?
And prosecute the war in MOP level 5.
Correct. And now, I don't think most people are even taught what MOP level 5 is. They're familiar with MOP level 1. They're familiar with MOP level 2, 3, and 4. MOP level 4 is basically what everybody got used to, and that's where you had the full MOP suit on, you had the gloves, the boots on, you had the mask on, you had the hood on the mask, okay? And that was basically MOP level 4. Now, MOP level 5, which was absolutely required for any of this stuff, is the only thing we had available to it is you had to take the rain poncho and then put the poncho over everything and then duct tape the poncho in. So literally seize everything out. And this would get you pretty close to, you know, a level 3 or a level 4 for a civilian there. Andres Carnegie Both had written the publication, again, this wasn't a peer-reviewed journal, The Role of Sand in Chemical Warfare Agent Exposure Among Persian Gulf War Veterans.
It was a military...
Medicine. Yeah,
and
again,
I quoted that on my first trip up there, and as I walked back, I hear the Hungarian voice of, you quoted my research. And that's how I met Karini Both.
Yeah,
that
was
my classroom meeting, everybody.
It was teamed LS-CAN disease, and what had happened is we had scuds that came in S-CAN Village, and it was over by the grain elevators where we definitely had the chemical weapons on them. And so we had the smells and everything else. We had the alarms going off all over S-CAN Village, and then we started seeing the health effects and everything. And so as a consequence, Andres had picked up all this almost immediately and reported and come out. Again, it's a dusty agent. It's a dusty warfare agent. The dust becomes a warfare agent when chemical toxins are micro-impregnated into inert particles. The dirty
all
dust
the oil-filled particulates, all the chemical products, the DU, I mean, everything would become a tremendous biological, chemical mess.
Correct. And we identified this rapidly. We tried to get it out. We put it into our courses as we're teaching. We taught not only medical management, chemical and biological casualties course, we did the full NBC refresher and all the other stuff too, but then we did the combat lifesaver course. Combat lifesaver course before Desert Storm was basically 100 hours, and they didn't have the time or the effort or the instructors or anything. And so what had happened is Sergeant First Class Ronald Dolph and I, Command Sergeant Major Jim Runge, again, Sergeant First Class John Sitton. I mean, John Sitton was one of the first on our team to die of lung cancer. He was denied medical care at the Danville VA Medical Center, Ileana VA Medical Center in Danville, Illinois, and he died of lung cancer in Springfield Memorial in Springfield, Illinois. It was a horrific night when we got word on all that stuff. But we had gone about and we taught that course in, and then we modified it, and then we continued to teach it.
And
well, after Desert Storm.
All during the teaching, the reports were coming in, going to CINCOM.
Correct. All the information was coming on down. We had all of the health effects from the oil well fires. We had health effects from hazardous materials. All the health effects were known from the CARC paint. All the health effects were known from the pesticides. All the health effects were already known from the what Andres dubbed LSCAN disease, and this is where all the chemical and biological weapons were blown up and then got all over theater. Again, Jimmy Toot has done incredible work on that. So all the stuff was known, and everything was coming on down. And so we put all the warnings out and attempted to get everything done. But again, all this stuff got squashed. For example, the depleted uranium is probably the easiest one to understand. The first warning we got on depleted uranium was a letter that came in the U.S. mail from the Pentagon in December of 1990. Didn't come from the official chain. It came through the U.S. mail to all of us in theater, the health physicists. And I was a theater health physicist at the Theater Command Headquarters doing NBC and everything else. Now, a health physicist at a MedCom is totally different than somebody would think of as a health physicist in a hospital.
Yeah,
we're hazmat and NBC guys. We're nothing but combat medics that clean up the garbage.
Right.
I mean, we're scientists, but we're a totally different ball game. We're not meter swingers, although we ended up doing that stuff. We're a totally different game. We're actually out there cleaning up the mess, getting into the garbage, and that's why we all got exposed and we all got sick, and so many are dead today. It's just a horrific, horrific problem. And so we got that warning, and we put out. We didn't think anything of it until, with the ground war, they ended up having most of the casualties, and all of the U.S. vehicles that were destroyed were mostly friendly fire. I did lose three Abrams tanks to enemy fire. Okay, so we had to clean that up. I want to repeat: we did lose three Abrams tanks to enemy fire. That's Iraqi combat operations. The rest of the tanks that we lost, the other 16 tanks, were basically DU-friendly fire, along with the 15 Bradley fighting vehicles that we can absolutely confirm. So I had over 31 vehicles. I mean, this is just on the U.S. alone, Bradleys and Abrams, and this doesn't include all the other stuff that we had. And then we had, obviously, all the other British that were actually shot up by the A-10s and the also shot up by the Abrams. Again, we were refused to provide care to the British and let them know and take care of all that stuff. But what had happened, and you've got a copy of it, it's seen, it's been out there. People can pull it up. I've sent it out there. It's on grassrootspeace.org. Sonny Miller and Charlie Jenks have done an incredible group. We get it out there, again, working with everything, where we had the two memos that came on down in March of 1991. Again, Franks gave them to me, and one was the Los Alamos Memorandum. The other one was a Defense Nuclear Agency Memorandum. In the Defense Nuclear Agency Memorandum, what it said, that depleted uranium is a serious health hazard, all the problems, incredible problems, we need to take care of it and clean it up and do it, everything else. And that basically got me assigned to do the mess and clean up the mess.
And what people may not have known is a lot of sand was dug up from Kuwait, from the Highway of Death, down to whatever certain level, and it was shipped back here to go to Utah.
it's turned into a whole mess on this stuff. I mean, there was stuff brought all the way back, and everything was consolidated down to Camp Doha when Camp Doha blew up and all that stuff and everything else. And then,
but what I'm going to say is, if it was not hazardous to have expended the funds to do that kind of activity, ship all this contaminated sand, and break environmental regulations shipping it and everything else.
It was brought back to Boise, Idaho, to American Ecology, is where it's at.
Then they knew. They knew.
Oh,
this
absolutely.
This is what it's coming down to, is that they knew, and I'm kind of bringing this because it's 5:52, Doug, so we've got a few minutes here, but they've known. And our generals have not stood up and led to get the compensation rapidly, presumptions, a fast-tracking on them, and to focus on, let's find ways, if we can, for diagnostic testing that's needed for our troops now, needed past tense now, and see if they can find some kind of treatment. I know that radiation, that people that were exposed at nuclear plants got chelation pretty rapidly.
Yeah. Well, generally, now the other thing on the failure with the generals is General Eric Shinseki wrote the original, well, wrote one of the original orders based on my direct input, our team's input in 1993. His order was for all the depleted uranium medical care, for all the training on depleted uranium, and all the environmental remediation. He issued that order in August of 1993 based on our input, and that was as we had started the U.S. Army Environmental Policy Institute study on depleted uranium right here.
And right,
in fact,
and you also presented at a very special meeting of commanders after the war.
Yeah,
was
that was in
Wright-Patterson.
Wright-Patterson, that was in late January, early February of 1992. I was recalled to active duty again and sent out there to present all this stuff. And both the depleted uranium and the oil well were the two main concerns at that time. And that did result in the AEPIDU study, but then the oil well stuff got kiboshed put on until Andres stood up there in the CDC meeting in 1999 and told the truth.
Now let's quickly talk about the retaliation that's occurred.
The retaliation is ongoing.
He was in control or command of a large hospital unit.
Yeah, I mean, we got Andres Carnegie Bopp has had continuous retaliation. We've had the same thing with
Dr. Durakovich.
Colonel Dr. Asa Durakovich, continuous retaliation. Same thing with Tom Little and all of us involved. I've had continuous retaliation. Dr. Mikey Kilpatrick has gone on the record, so much public record, saying that us were there, we weren't the experts, we didn't do the research, we didn't have the findings, and even when he knew perfectly well that we did, because he'd asked for our input and our help to help him solve the problems. But what we found out, that was all about trying to figure out how to cover everything up. The same thing we found out when we worked with PSOP, Mikey Nalen, and then, God bless him, another admiral who's gone and died, was Admiral Elmo Zumwalt, and that's a whole Agent Orange nightmare that comes up.
We're at 5:54, and what I've tried to guide you through is why we're frustrated, have mixed feelings about Stormin Norman's death, that we respect him, but that we have wished that he had stood up and led the troops and led to get their diagnostic and treatment and their compensation. And compensation, you know, we can get presumptive coverage, but to get more direct service connection, per se, would take the high level of diagnostic work that researchers have been struggling to do and going through their own retaliation, like Haley and the collaborative center, and then all that being stopped. So there's been retaliation on our researchers, you know, particularly early on in the 90s.
It continues.
And in the 2000, Dr. Bomswiger faced retaliation, Dr. Kathleen Leisure Murray. We had a coroner come out and judge a death related to Gulf War illness, and she was fired. So, you know, do you call this a cover-up, a betrayal of trust? What do you call it?
I don't know. It's time for the general stand-up. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll continue this next week. We'd like everybody to join the conversation next week on a call-in and your memories and understanding of what happened. Again, God bless America. We got to stand up. We got to take care of it. The generals, it's up to them, guys. You're our bosses. Join us and help us. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Have a good evening, and Happy New Year.